Susan walked back through the motionless streets, sat down in Madame Froult's office, and let herself sink back into the stream of time. She had never found out how this worked. It just did. Time didn't stop for the rest of the world, and it didn't stop for her. It was just that she entered a kind of loop of time, and everything else stayed exactly as it was until she'd finished what she needed to do. It was another inherited family trait. It worked best if you didn't think about it, just like tightrope walking. Anyway, now she had other things to think about. Madame Froult turned her gaze back from the rat-free mantelpiece. "Oh," she said. "It seems to have gone." "It was probably a trick of the light, madam," said Susan. "Mostly mortal. Someone like me," she thought.
Yes, of course.
Madame Froult managed to get her glasses on, despite the fact that the string was still tangled with the button. It meant that she'd moored herself to her own chest, but she was damned if she was going to do anything about it now. Susan could unnerve a glacier. All she had to do was sit quietly, looking polite and alert. "What precisely was it you wanted, madam?" she said. "It's only that I've left the class doing algebra, and they get restless when they've finished."
"Algebra!" said Madame Froult,
perforce staring at her own bosom, which no one else had ever done.
"But that's far too difficult for 7-year-olds.
"Yes, but I didn't tell them that, and so far they haven't found out," said Susan. It was time to move things along. "I expect you wanted to see me about my letter, madam," she said. Madame Froult looked blank.
"Well,"
she began. Susan sighed and snapped her fingers. She walked around and opened a drawer by the motionless Madame Froult, removed a sheet of paper, and spent some time carefully writing a letter. She let the ink dry, rustled the paper a bit to make it look slightly second-hand, and then put it just under the top of the pile of paperwork beside Madame Froult, with enough of it peeking out so that it would be easy to see. She returned to her seat. She snapped her fingers again.
"What letter?" said Madame Froult.
And then she looked down at her desk.
"Oh."
It was a cruel thing to do, Susan knew. But while Madame Froult was not by any means a bad person, and was quite kind to children, in a haphazard way, she was silly. And Susan did not have a lot of time for silly. "Yes, I asked if I might have a few days' leave," said Susan. "Pressing family matters, I am afraid. I have prepared some work for the children to get on with, of course." Madame Froult hesitated. Susan didn't have time for this, either. She snapped her fingers.
"My goodness, that'd be a relief,"
she said in a voice whose harmonics went all the way into the subconscious.
"If we don't slow her down, we'll run out of things to teach them. She has been performing small miracles on a daily basis and deserves a raise."
Then she sat back, snapped her fingers again, and watched the words settle into the forefront of Madame Froult's mind. The woman's lips actually moved.
Why, yes, of course," she murmured at last. "You have been working very hard, and
there are some things even a voice of eldritch command can't achieve, and one of them is to get extra money out of a head teacher.
We shall have to think about a little increment for you one of these days."
Susan returned to the classroom and spent the rest of the day performing small miracles, which included removing the glue from Richenda's hair, emptying the wee out of Billy's shoes, and treating the class to a short visit to the continent of Forex. When the parents came to pick them up, they were all waving crayoned pictures of kangaroos, and Susan had to hope that the red dust on their shoes, red mud in the case of Billy's, whose sense of timing had not improved, would pass unnoticed. It probably would. Fidgets was not the only place where adults didn't see what couldn't possibly be true. Now, she sat back. There was something pleasant about an empty classroom. Of course, as any teacher would point out, one nice thing was that there were no children in it, and particularly no Jason. But the tables and shelves around the room showed evidence of a term well spent. Paintings lined the walls and showed good use of perspective and color. The class had built a full-sized white horse cut out of cardboard, during which time they'd learned a lot about horses, and Susan learned about Jason's remarkably accurate powers of observation. She'd had to take the cardboard tube away from him and explain that this was a polite horse. It had been a long day. She raised the lid of her desk and took out Grimm Fairy Tales. This dislodged some paperwork, which in turn revealed a small cardboard box decorated in black and gold. It had been a little present from Vincent's parents. She stared at the box. Every day she had to go through this. It was ridiculous. It wasn't even as if Higgs and Meekins did good chocolate. They were just butter and sugar and... She scrabbled among the sad little scraps of brown paper inside the box and pulled out a chocolate. No one could be expected not to have just one chocolate after all. She put it in her mouth. Damn, 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 damn! It was nougat inside. Her one chocolate today. And it was damn artificial, damn pink and white, damn sickly, damn stupid nougat. Well, no one could be expected to believe that counted.
This is true. A chocolate you did not want to eat does not count as chocolate. This discovery is from the same branch of culinary physics that determined that food eaten while walking along contains no calories.
She was entitled to another. The teacher part of her, which had eyes in the back of its head, caught the blur of movement. She spun around. No running with scythes. The death of Rat stopped jogging along the nature table and gave her a guilty look. Squeak? And no going into the stationery cupboard either, said Susan automatically. She slammed the desk lid shut. Squeak! Yes, you were. I could hear you thinking about it. It was possible to deal with the death of Rats, provided you thought of him as a very small Jason. The stationery cupboard. That was one of the great battlegrounds of classroom history, that and the playhouse. But the ownership of the playhouse usually sorted itself out without Susan's intervention, so that all she had to do was be ready with ointment, a noseblow, and mild sympathy for the losers. Whereas the stationery cupboard was a war of attrition. It contained pots of powdered paint, and reams of paper, and boxes of crayons, and more idiosyncratic items like a spare pair of pants for Billy, who did his best. It also contained the scissors, which under classroom rules were treated as some kind of doomsday machine. And of course, the boxes of stars. The only people allowed in the cupboard were Susan and, usually, Vincent. Despite everything Susan had tried, short of actual deception, he was always the official best at everything, and won the coveted honor every day, which was to go into the stationery cupboard and fetch the pencils and hand them out. For the rest of the class, and especially Jason, the stationery cupboard was some mystic magic realm to be entered whenever possible. Honestly, thought Susan, once you learn the arts of defending the stationery cupboard, outwitting Jason, and keeping the class pet alive until the end of term, you've mastered at least half of teaching. She signed the register, watered the sad plants on the windowsill, went and fetched some fresh privet from the hedge for the stick insects that were the successors to Henry the Hamster, chosen on the basis that it was quite hard to tell when they were dead, tidied a few errant crayons away, and looked around the classroom at all those little chairs. It sometimes worried her that nearly everyone she knew well was 3 feet high. She was never certain that she trusted her grandfather at times like this. It was all to do with the rules. He couldn't interfere, but he knew her weaknesses, and he could wind her up and send her out into the world. Someone like me. Yes, he'd known how to engage her interest. Someone like me. Suddenly there's some dangerous clock somewhere in the world, and suddenly I'm told that there's someone like me. Someone like me. Except not like me. At least I knew my parents. And she'd listened to Death's account of the tall, dark woman wandering from room to room in the endless castle of glass, weeping for the child she'd given birth to, and could see every day, but could never touch. Where do I even begin?
Lopsang learned a lot. He learned that every room had at least 4 corners. He learned that the sweepers started work when the sky was light enough to see the dust and continued until sunset. As a master, Lutzer was kind enough. He would always point out those bits that Lopsang had not done properly. After the initial anger and the taunting of his former classmates, Lopsang found that the work had a certain charm. Days drifted past under his broom. Until, almost with an audible click in his brain, he decided that enough was enough. He finished his section of passageway and found Lutzer dreamily pushing his brush along a terrace. Sweeper? Yes, lad? What is it you are trying to tell me? I'm sorry? I didn't expect to become a sweeper. You're Lutzer. I expected to be apprenticed to, well, to the hero. You did? Lutzer scratched his beard. Oh, dear. Yes, I can see the problem. Oh, you should have said. Why didn't you say? I don't really do that sort of thing anymore. You don't? Oh, all that playing with history, running about, unsettling people. No, not really. I was never quite certain that we should be doing it, to be honest. No, sweeping's good enough for me. There's something real about a nice clean floor.
This is a test, isn't it? Said Lopsang coldly.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I understand how it works. The master makes the pupil do all the menial jobs, and then it turns out that really the pupil is learning things of great value. And I don't think I'm learning anything, really, except that people are pretty messy and inconsiderate.
I'm not a bad lesson all the same, said Lutzer. Is it not written? Hard work never did anybody any harm.
Where is it written, Lutzer? Said Lopsang, thoroughly exasperated. The sweeper brightened up.
Ah, he said, perhaps the pupil is ready to learn. Then you don't wish to know the way of the sweeper? You wish to learn instead the way of Mrs. Cosmopolite.
Who?
We have swept well. Let's go to the gardens. For is it not written, it does you good to get out in the fresh air?
Is it? Said Lopsang, still bewildered. Lutzer pulled a small tattered notebook out of his pocket.
In here it is, he said. I should know.
Lutzer patiently adjusted a tiny mirror to redirect sunlight more favorably on one of the bonsai mountains. He hummed tunelessly under his breath. Lopsang, sitting cross-legged on the stones, carefully turned the yellowing pages of the ancient notebook, on which was written in faded ink, The Way of Mrs. Cosmopolite.
Well, said Lutzer.
The way has an answer for everything, does it?
Yes.
Then Lobsang nodded at the little volcano, which was gently smoking. How does that work? It's on a saucer. Lutzer stared straight ahead, his lips moving.
Page 76, I think, he said.
Lobsang turned to the page. Because, he read.
Good answer,
said Lutzer, gently caressing a minute crag with a camel hair brush. Just because, master? No reason?
Reason? What reason can a mountain have? And as you accumulate years, you will learn that most answers boil down eventually to because.
Lobsang said nothing. The Book of the Way was giving him problems. What he wanted to say was this. Lutzer, this reads like a book of the sayings of an old lady. It's the sort of thing old ladies say. What kind of koan is, it won't get better if you picket it, or eat it up, it'll make your hair curly, or everything comes to he who waits. This is the stuff you get in Hogswatch crackers.
Really?
Said Lutzer, still apparently engrossed in a mountain. I didn't say anything.
Oh, I thought you did.
Do you miss Ankh-Morpork? Yes, I didn't have to sweep floors there.
Were you a good thief?
I was a fantastic thief. A breeze blew a scent of cherry blossom.
Just once, thought Lutzer, it'd be nice to pick cherries.
I've been to Ankh-Morpork,
he said, straightening up and moving on to the next mountain.
You've seen the visitors we get here.
Yes, said Lobsang. Everyone laughs at them.
Really?
Lutzer raised his eyebrows.
When they have trekked thousands of miles seeking the truth?
But did not Wen say that if the truth is anywhere, it is everywhere? Said Lobsang.
Well done! I see you've learned something at least.
But one day it seemed to me that everyone else had decided that wisdom can only be found a long way off. So I went to Ankh-Morpork. They were all coming here, so it seemed only fair.
Seeking enlightenment?
No, the wise man does not seek enlightenment. He waits for it. So, while I was waiting, it occurred to me that seeking perplexity might be more fun, said Lutzer. After all, enlightenment begins where perplexity ends. And I found perplexity. And a kind of enlightenment, too. I had not been there 5 minutes, for example, when some men in an alley tried to enlighten me of what little I possessed, giving me a valuable lesson in the ridiculousness of material things.
But why Ankh-Morpork? Said Lobsang.
Look in the back of the book, said Lutzer.
There was a yellow, crackling scrap of paper tucked in there. The boy unfolded it. Oh, this is just a bit of the almanac, he said. It's very popular there.
Yes, a seeker after wisdom left it here.
Well, it's just got the phases of the moon on this page.
Other side, said the sweeper.
Lobsang turned the paper over. But it's just an advert from the Ankh-Morpork Guild of Merchants, said Lobsang. Ankh-Morpork has everything. He stared at the smiling Lutzer. And you thought that...
Ah, I am old and simple, and understand, said the sweeper, whereas you are young and complicated. Didn't Wen see portents in the swirl of gruel in his bowl, and the flight of birds? This was actually written. I mean, flights of birds are quite complex, but these were words, and I saw the opening of the way, my way.
And you went all the way to Ankh-Morpork, said Lobsang weakly.
And I fetched up, calm of mind but empty of pocket, in Quirm Street, said the sweeper,
smiling serenely at the recollection.
And I espied a sign in a window saying, Rooms to Rent. Thus I met Mrs. Cosmopolite, who opened the door when I knocked, and then, when I hesitated, not being sure of the language, she said, I haven't got all day, you know, almost to a word, one of the sayings of Wen. Instantly, I knew that I'd found what I was seeking. But during the days, I washed dishes in an eating house for 20 pence a day and all the scraps I could take away, and in the evenings, I helped Mrs. Cosmopolite clean the house and listened carefully to her conversation. She was a natural sweeper with a good rhythmical motion and had bottomless wisdom. Within the first 2 days, she uttered to me the actual words said by Wen upon understanding the true nature of time. It was when I asked for a reduced rate because, of course, I did not sleep in a bed, and she said, "I was not born yesterday, Mr. Zer." Astonishing. And she could never have seen the sacred text.
Lobsang's face was a carefully drawn picture. "I was not born yesterday," he said.
"Ah, yes, of course, as a novice you would not have got that far," said Lutzer. "It was when he fell asleep in a cave, and in a dream saw time appear to him and show him that the universe is recreated from second to second, endlessly. And he stepped out from the cave into the truly new world and said, 'I was not born yesterday.'"
"Oh, yes," said Lobsang, "but..."
"Ah, Mrs. Cosmopolite," said Lutzer, his eyes misting over. "What a woman for keeping things clean. If she was a sweeper here, no one would be allowed to walk on the floor. Her house so amazing, a palace. New sheets every other week, and cook! Just to taste her beans baked upon the toast, a man would give up a cycle of the universe."
"Hmm," said Lobsang.
"I stayed for 3 months, sweeping her house as is fitting for the pupil, and then I returned here, my way clear before me."
"And these stories about you?"
"Oh, all true. Well, most of them. A bit of exaggeration, but mostly true."
"Well, the one about the citadel in Muntab, and the Pash, and the fishbone?"
"Oh, yes."
"But how did you get in where half a dozen trained and armed men couldn't even—"
"I'm a little man, and I carry a broom," said Lutzer simply. "Everyone has some mess that needs clearing up. What harm is a man with a broom?"
"What? And that was it?"
"Well, the rest was a matter of cookery, really. The Pash was not a good man, but he was a glutton for his fish pie."
"No martial arts?" said Lobsang.
"Oh, always as a last resort. History needs shepherds, not butchers."
"Do you know Okidoki?"
Just a lot of bunny hops."
"Shiitake?"
"Very fast," he said.
He leaned down and blew the petals away from a tiny glacier.
"You slice time as fast as a 10th gym, and as yet barely trained. You must have been a great thief. And now, oh dear, I shall have to face you in the dojo."
"No, there's no need," said Lobsang, because now Lutzer looked frightened and humiliated and somehow small and brittle-boned.
"Oh, I insist," said the old man. "Let us get it done now, for it is written, 'There is no time like the present,' which is Mrs. Cosmopolite's most profound understanding."
He sighed, and looked up at the giant statue of Wen.
"Look at him," he said. "He was a lad, eh? Completely blissed out on the universe. Saw the past and the future as one living person, and wrote the books of history to tell how the story should go. We can't imagine what those eyes saw. And he never raised a hand to any man in his life."
"Look, I really didn't want to—"
"And you've looked at the other statues?"
said Lutzer, as if he'd completely forgotten about the dojo. Distractedly, Lobsang followed his gaze. Up on the raised stone platform that ran the whole length of the garden were hundreds of smaller statues, mostly carved of wood, all of them painted in garish colours. Figures with more eyes than legs, more tails than teeth. Monstrous amalgamations of fish and squid and tiger and parsnip. Things put together as if the creator of the universe had tipped out his box of spare parts and stuck them together. Things painted pink and orange and purple and gold looked down over the valley.
"Oh, the Dlang," Lobsang began.
"Demons? Well, that's one word for them," said the sweeper. "The abbot called them the enemies of mind. Wen wrote a scroll about them, you know, and he said that was the worst."
He pointed to a little hooded grey shape, which looked out of place among the festival of wild extremities.
"It doesn't look very dangerous," said Lobsang.
"Look, sweeper, I don't want to—"
"They can be very dangerous, things that don't look dangerous," said Lutzer. "Not looking dangerous is what makes them dangerous, for it is written, 'You can't tell a book by its cover.'"
"Lutzer, I really don't want to fight you."
"Oh, your tutors will tell you that the discipline of a martial art enables you to slice time,
And that's true as far as it goes, said Lutzer, apparently not listening. But so can sweeping, as perhaps you've found. Always find the perfect moment, Wen said. People just seem so keen on using it to kick other people on the back of the neck. Oh, but it wasn't a challenge. I just wanted you to show me, and I shall. Come on, I made a bargain. I must keep it, old fool that I am. The nearest dojo was the dojo of the 10th gym. It was empty, except for two monks blurring as they danced across the mat and wrapped time around themselves. Lutzer had been right, Lobsang knew. Time was a resource. You could learn to let it move fast or slow, so that a monk could walk easily through a crowd and yet be moving so fast that no one could see him. Or he could stand still for a few seconds and watch the sun and moon chase one another across a flickering sky. He could meditate for a day in a minute. Here, in the valley, a day lasted forever. The blurred fighters became a couple of hesitant monks when they saw Lutzer. He bowed. I beg the use of this dojo for a short period while my apprentice teaches me the folly of old age, he said. Look, I really didn't mean, Lobsang began, but Lutzer elbowed him in the ribs. The monks gave the old man a nervous look. It's yours, Lutzer, said one of them. They hurried out, almost tripping over their own feet as they kept looking back. Time and its control is what we should teach here, said Lutzer, watching them go. The martial arts are an aid. That is all they are. At least, that's all they were meant to be. Even out in the world, a well-trained person may perceive in the fray how flexible time may be. Here, we can build on that. Compress time, stretch time, hold the moment. Punching people's kidneys out through their nose is only a foolish byproduct. Lutzer took down a razor-edged pika sword from the rack and handed it to the shop boy. You've seen one of these before? They're not really for novices, but you show promise. Well, yes, sweeper, but know how to use it. Well, I'm good at the practice ones, but they're just made of... Take it, then, and attack me. There was a rustling noise above them. Lobsang looked up and saw monks pouring into the observation gallery above the dojo. There were some very senior ones among them. News gets around quickly in a little world. Rule 2, said Lutzer, is... Never refuse a weapon. He took a few steps back. In your own time, boy. Lobsang wielded the curved sword uncertainly. Well, said Lutzer, I can't just... Is this the dojo of the 10th gym? Said Lutzer. Why, mercy me, I do believe it is. That means there are no rules, doesn't it? Any weapon, any strategy, anything is allowed. Do you understand? Are you stupid? And I can't kill someone just because they've asked me to. Why not? What happened to Mr. Manners? But you are holding a deadly weapon. You are facing an unarmed man in a pose of submission. Are you frightened? Yes, yes, I am. Good. That's rule 3, said Lutzer quietly. See how much you're learning already? Wipe the smile off your face, have I? All right. Put the sword on the rack and take a dakka stick. The most you can do with that is bruise my old bones. Look, I would prefer it if you wore the protective padding. Oh, you're that good with a stick, are you? I'm very fast. Then, if you don't fight right now, I shall wrest it from you and break it over your head, said Lutzer, drawing back. Ready? The only defense is to attack well, I'm told. Lobsang raised the stick in reluctant salute. Lutzer folded his hands, and, as Lobsang danced toward him, closed his eyes and smiled to himself. Lobsang raised the stick and hesitated. Lutzer was grinning. Rule 2. Rule 3. What had been Rule 1? Always remember Rule 1. Lutzer! The abbot's chief acolyte arrived panting in the doorway, waving urgently. Lutzer opened one eye, and then the other one, and then winked at Lobsang. Narrow escape there, eh? He said. He turned to the acolyte. Yes, exalted sir.
You must come immediately, and all monks who are cleared for a tour in the world to the Mandala Hall, now!
There was a scuffling in the gallery,
and several monks pushed their way out through the crowd.
Ah, excitement, said Lutzer, taking the stick from Lobsang's unresisting hands and putting it back into the rack.
The hall was emptying fast. Around the whole of Oidong, gongs were being banged frantically.
What's happening?
Said Lobsang, as the last of the monks surged past.
I dare say we shall soon be told, said Lutzer, starting to roll himself a cigarette.
Well, hadn't we better hurry? Everyone's going.
The sound of flapping sandals died away in the distance.
Well, nothing seems to be on fire, said Lutzer calmly. Besides, if we wait a little, then by the time we get there, everyone will have stopped shouting, and perhaps they will be making some sense. Let us take the clock path. The display is particularly fine at this time of day.
But...
It is written, you've got to learn to walk before you can run, said Lutzer, putting his broom over his shoulder.
Mrs. Cosmopolite again?
Amazing woman. Dusted like a demon, too.
The clock path wound out from the main complex, up through the terraced gardens, and then rejoined the wider path as it tunnelled into the cliff wall. Novices always asked why it was called the clock path, since there was no sign of a clock anywhere. More gongs started to bang, but they were muffled by the greenery. Lobsang heard more running feet up on the main path. Down here, hummingbirds flickered from flower to flower, oblivious to any excitement.
I wonder what time it is, said Lutzer, who was walking ahead.
Everything is a test.
Lobsang glanced around at the flower bed.
9:15, he said.
Oh? And how did you know that?
The field marigold is open, the red sandwort is opening, the purple bindweed is closed, and the yellow goat's beard is closing, said Lobsang.
You worked out the floral clock all by yourself?
Oh, yes, it's obvious.
Really? What time is it when the white water lily opens?
6 in the morning.
You came to look?
Yes. You planted this garden, did you?
One of my little efforts.
It's beautiful.
Well, it's not very accurate in the small hours. There aren't too many night-blooming plants that grow well up here. They open for the moths, you know.
It's how time wants to be measured, said Lobsang.
Really? Of course, I'm not an expert, said Lutzer.
He pinched out the end of his cigarette and stuck it behind his ear.
If I wanted to thrust my hand into hot sand, I would go to the seaside.
Upsy-daisy?
Waste of good bricks.
No can do.
You made that one up.
Tongue pea?
Bad-tempered flower arranging.
Deja vu? That got a reaction. Lutzer's eyebrows raised.
Deja vu? You heard that rumor? Time as a weapon? He said. Ha! None of the monks here knows deja vu. I'd soon hear about it if they did. Look, boy, violence is the resort of the violent. In most tight corners, a broomstick suffices.
Only most, eh? Said Lobsang, not trying to hide the sarcasm.
Oh, I see. You wish to face me in the dojo? For it's a very old truth. When the pupil can beat the master, there is nothing the master cannot tell him because the apprenticeship is ended. You want to learn? Ah, I knew there was something to learn.
Lutzer stood up.
Why you? He said.
Why here?
Why now? There is a time and a place for everything. Why this time and this place? If I take you to the dojo, you will return what you stole from me. Now!
He looked down at the teak table where he worked on his mountains. The little shovel was there. A few cherry blossom petals fluttered to the ground.
I see, he said. You are that fast? I did not see you.
Lobsang said nothing.
It is a small and worthless thing, said Lutzer. Why did you take it, please?
To see if I could. I was bored.
Ah, we shall see if we can make life more interesting for you, then. No wonder you are bored when you can already slice time like that.
Lutzer turned the little shovel over and over in his hand.
Oh, well, let's keep going. Everyone may have stopped arguing at cross purposes by now. How do you feel about going through the mandala hall again?
Oh, I'll be fine. I'd just forgotten about it, that's all.
Really? And you'd never seen it before, too, but time plays funny tricks on us all. Why, I once...
Lutza stopped and stared at the apprentice.
You're right, he said. You've gone pale.
Lobsang grimaced and shook his head. Something felt odd, he said. He vaguely waved a hand in the direction of the lowlands, spread out in a blue and grey pattern on the horizon. Something over there. The glass clock. The great glass house, and here, where it shouldn't be, the glass clock. It was barely here. It showed up as shimmering lines in the air, as if it was possible to capture the sparkle of light off a shiny surface without the surface itself. Everything here was transparent. Delicate chairs, tables, vases, the flowers. And now he realized that glass was not a word to use here. Crystal might be better, or ice. The thin, flawless ice you sometimes got after a sharp frost. Everything was visible only by its edges. He could make out staircases through distant walls. Above and below and to every side, the glass rooms went on forever. And yet, it was all familiar. It felt like home. Sound filled the glass rooms. It streamed away in clear, sharp notes, like the tones made by a wet finger around a wine glass rim. There was movement, too. A haze in the air beyond the transparent walls, shifting and wavering and watching him.
How can it come from over there? And how do you mean odd? Said the voice of Lutza.
Lobsang blinked.
This was the odd place,
the one right here, the rigid and unbending world. And then the feeling passed and faded.
Just odd, for a moment, he mumbled.
There was dampness on his cheek. He raised his hand and touched wetness.
It's that rancid yak butter they put in the tea, I've always said so, said Lutza. Mrs. Cosmopolite, never. Now, that is unusual, he said, looking up.
What? What?
Said Lobsang, looking blankly at his wet fingertips, and then up at the cloudless sky.
A procrastinator going over speed.
He shifted position.
Can't you feel it?
I can't hear anything, said Lobsang.
Not hear, feel. Coming up through your sandals. Oops, there goes another one.
And another one.
You can't feel it. That's old 66. They've never got it properly balanced. We'll hear them in a minute. Oh, dear. Look at the flowers. Do look at the flowers.
Lobsang turned. The ice plants were opening. The field south of all was closing.
Time leak, said Lutza. Hark at that. You can hear them now, eh? They're dumping time randomly. Come on!
According to the second scroll of Wen the Eternally Surprised, Wen the Eternally Surprised sawed the first procrastinator from the trunk of a wham-wham tree, carved certain symbols on it, fitted it with a bronze spindle, and summoned the apprentice, Claudepool.
Ah, very nice, master, said Claudepool. A prayer wheel, yes?
No, this is nothing like as complex, said Wen. It merely stores and moves time.
That's simple, eh?
And now I shall test it, said Wen. He gave it a half turn with his hand.
Ah, very nice, master, said Claudepool. A prayer wheel, yes?
No, this is nothing like as complex, said Wen. It merely stores and moves time.
That's simple, eh?
And now I shall test it, said Wen. He moved it a little less this time.
That's simple, eh?
And now I shall test it, said Wen. This time he twisted it gently to and fro.
That's simple, eh?
Said Claudepool. And I have tested it, said Wen.
It worked, master?
Yes, I think so. Wen stood up. Give me the rope that you used to carry the firewood, and, yes, a pit from one of those cherries that you picked yesterday. He wound the frayed rope around the cylinder and tossed the pit onto a patch of mud. Claudepool jumped out of the way. "See those mountains?" said Wen, tugging the rope. The cylinder spun and balanced there, humming gently.
"Oh, yes, master," said Claudepool obediently.
There was practically nothing up here but mountains. There were so many that sometimes they were impossible to see because they got in the way. "How much time does stone need?" said Wen. "Oh, the deep sea. We shall move it," he placed his left hand just above the spinning blur, "to where it is needed." He looked down at the cherry pit. His lips moved silently, as though he was working through some complex puzzle. Then he pointed his right hand at the pit. "Stand back," he said, and gently let a finger touch the cylinder. There was no sound except the crack of the air as it moved aside and a hiss of steam from the mud. Wen looked up at the new tree and smiled. "I did say you should stand back," he said.
I shall get down now, then, shall I?" said a voice among the blossom-laden branches.
"But carefully," said Wen, and sighed as Claudepool crashed down in a shower of petals. "There will always be cherry blossom here," he said.
End of side 5.